Our book of the week this week has been The Valley, Richard Benson's portrait of 100 years and the life of one Yorkshire family. We followed the story of the author's grandmother, Winnie, and learned about her affair with her husband's cousin, Alf. After Alf's departure in January 1949, Winnie gave birth to a daughter, Linda, and Harry treated the baby as his own. In time, Linda's elder siblings moved away, but still a teenager, she remained at home. The reader is Richard Stacey.
It's a lovely day tomorrow. Tomorrow is a lovely day. Come and feast your tear-dimmed eyes on tomorrow's clear blue skies.
One Saturday afternoon in 1966, Linda and her boyfriend, Kevin, are sitting on Winnie's new orange crushed velvet settee. They're halfway through a Dave Clark 5 album when Kevin says, "Your dad's not your real dad, is he?" Linda makes a "what are you talking about" face. "Yes, of course he is." "That's not what I've been told." "By who?" "By Bruce Phillips." Linda feels her certainty leave her with the sudden pop of a stylus lifting from an LP. "What did Bruce say?" "He just said to me, 'Her dad's not a real dad.'" "Well," she declares, "he is so far as I know, so Bruce can mind his own business. Shall I put another record on?" On Sunday, after she and her mam have had their roast dinner, Linda is lying in front of the fire, Winnie sitting on the sofa, crocheting a blanket. Harry's dinner is being kept warm in the kitchen until his return from the club. She and her mother are alone. "Mam, is Dad my real dad?" Winnie abruptly looks up from her crochet hooks. A moment passes. "Yes, he is," she snaps. "Why are you asking me?" "Somebody said something to me about him not being."
"Who?"
"Somebody at school. They told Kev."
"Who at school?"
"Bruce Phillips." "Tell Bruce Phillips to keep his mouth shut then and stop talking like that." In the end, confronted again a few days later, Winnie sits on the settee, knitting her thumbs, and tells Linda the story, from Alf first coming to the house with Sonny to him begging her to go away with him. "He was just always that kind to me, see? He used to come up and ask me if I was all right or just put his arm round me, and it was nice. Then one day when he was staying in front room, I went in to see something and he was there and we got talking and one thing led to another and that's when it happened." Later, she will tell Linda that she could equally well be Harry's daughter, but now she touches her daughter's temple and says softly, "I know you're our Alf's. Your hair grows like his, the way it kinks at the side there. It's the same." She's silent for a moment. "Will you promise me never to tell your dad that you know?" Linda knows she means Harry. "He's been good about it, and he's always treated you like his own. He'd die if he thought he knew what happened." Linda promises. It is an easy promise to make, because her feelings about her dad are unchanged. That night, her mind is mainly occupied by the discovery that her feelings of love and loyalty are determined more by someone's actions than by their biology. The realisation is liberating. Rather than weakening her love for Harry, it strengthens it. In February 1981, Winnie and Harry celebrate their golden wedding anniversary at Highgate Working Men's Club. 3 years later, they sit in their front room, comparing the events of the day to the strike of 1926. Both support the striking miners of 1984, though Harry is less sure about the cause. Another winter draws in, only this year Harry is very poorly. He's diagnosed with Parkinson's and becomes increasingly less coherent. One day, Linda comes round to see if her mum wants a hand and, hearing her voice in the front room, stops beside the door. "I've always loved you, Harry," Winnie is saying. Whatever happened, there was never anybody else I loved like I loved you. Linda knocks gently and pushes open the door. Harry is lying on the bed, awake but unspeaking, eyes yellow with jaundice.
Are you all right, ma'am?
Winnie nods. I was talking to your dad. He was looking at me when I was telling him. I think he was trying to say to me, and I loved you, but he couldn't get it out. Highgate, 1987. After the funeral, Winnie is left living alone for the first time in her life. What she feels is not solitude, but a companionable haunting. She senses Harry's presence in the shifting airs of the house and hears him in the floor creaks and latch rattles. From the kitchen window, she sees him at the garden gate, joking with men on the way to the allotment. Her memories are now edited and recast into scenes of unbroken love and contentment. Old arguments and betrayals become challenges that were overcome by their unchanging mutual devotion. It is as if she can now love him with the saved-up love she found unwanted when they first married, half a century of withheld words and tears now released and overwhelming her. One Saturday afternoon, Linda is at home and the phone rings. It is Maureen, one of her cousins on her dad's side of the family.
I've got someone here who wants to see you. Can he come up?
Maureen's tone gives nothing away, but even so, Linda knows immediately who it is. She feels a light wave of nausea.
Yeah, she says. Yeah, all right. Bring him to me mum's.
When she sees him walking down the backings in his light overcoat and grey suit, her first thought is that he looks younger than she expected. Her second is that he looks a bit like Harry. But then he is a Hollingworth, after all.
Hello, she says.
Hello, he replies. I'm Alf, love. It's good to meet you.
Over the years since she first told Linda about Alf, Winnie has loosed enough details for her to put together the whole story. She knows about his leaving and his promise to return, and all about his character and feelings for her mam.
Are you all right then?
She says, as they wait for Winnie to come downstairs. She is aware of talking as if they were relatives who hadn't seen each other for a few months.
Yes, thank you, love. Are you?
Aye, not so bad.
The conversation is slow, but then what do you discuss with a man you've never met before but who may be your father?
The weather?
Turned out nice anyway, she says.
Winnie comes in with her hair brushed smart. Alf looks across the room with wide eyes and a smile that is half joy and half apprehension.
Hello, Winnie.
Hello.
To Linda's surprise, she's curt, almost offhand.
Are you all right then?
Aye, not bad.
Linda makes a pot of tea, and the three of them sit round the table discussing families and the past in Highgate. They do not progress beyond small talk and at no point go anywhere near the subject of Alf and Winnie's affair or Linda's birth. Alf is a pleasant man, but she would like to tell him that she is Harry's daughter, and that is that. As she cannot, she's obliged to talk to him and her mam about the Hollingworths and about Alf's home in the East Riding. Winnie does not ask questions and appears no more interested in Alf than in the mantelpiece clock. Her rescue ache faded years ago, and even if it hadn't, her attraction to him would have been killed by her renewed and pious posthumous love for Harry. Linda wonders briefly if Alf will stay, but at 4 o'clock, after more tea and slices of cake, he gets up and says he must be making tracks. As Alf walks away, Winnie turns and goes back inside.
Honestly, what did he come for?
She asks, as she tidies away the tea things.
I think he just wanted to see you, Mother.
I'm sure I don't know what he wanted. Well, I don't think it was
you know. You're in your 70s, and he's not so far off. What's that got to do with it? I could tell from where he was looking at me he was thinking summat.
Let her enjoy her outrage, thinks Linda.
You can tell him to keep away in future.
All right, I'll tell him. But Linda does not tell him, because Alf has understood. He doesn't come back. Neither she nor Winnie will see him again. In her 87th year, Winnie is found to be in the early stages of leukemia and Parkinson's disease and is moved to a permanent place in a care home. When Linda visits her mam, she finds her sitting in the lounge, a long, rubber-tiled room with high-backed chairs around the walls. Seated in the chairs, the residents either roost mutely or chat while their eyes search the room for a younger person who might play the piano for them. Winnie belongs to the former group, keeping herself apart and twisting her thumbs together as if by concentrating hard enough she could knit the past back out of the air and turn the world inside out, with herself at its centre, rather than its edges. Months and years pass. Winnie's bouts of delusion lengthen. Always she is a young version of herself in her own house, with Walter and Annie and neighbours around her, but no husband, or at least not one that she mentions. In these years, regeneration projects are changing the look of the valley so rapidly that when Pauline and Gordon go for a drive after visiting Winnie, they lose their way and cannot work out where they are. Gigantic windowless warehouses and industrial units seem to be dropped from the sky at night, their mystical quality enhanced by their desertedness. No one ever seems to see people either going into or coming out of them. More industrial landscape is reclaimed, and everywhere there are new roads, call centres, golf courses, houses, retail parks. Winnie's funeral takes place at Barnsley's Municipal Crematorium on a cold, overcast morning in January 2002. By the time they've filed into the chapel, people are standing in rows two and three deep at the back. It is unusual these days, the vicar will tell Linda later, for someone of 92. The vicar had not known Winnie, but he's talked about her with her family and other acquaintances, and, he says, in these conversations, two qualities always were mentioned: her capacity for hard work, and second, her privacy. He tells the mourners, she was a private person, and someone whose home was of the utmost importance to her. And when they sing the last hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful, it seems to Pauline, seated at the front near the coffin, that even though the hymn is very well known and commonly heard, its lyrics could have been addressed to Winnie because, for better or worse, she had understood the greatness of the small things of home.
Richard Stacey was reading the final extract from The Valley by Richard Benson. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production. Lauren Laverne is the guest presenter on Woman's Hour after the news.
On BBC Radio
6 Music. Music's always gone hand in hand with social change, and sometimes just one song can galvanise an entire movement.
Come gather around people wherever you're on.
On Bank Holiday Monday, join me, Jolyon Rubinstein, as we take a not-so-serious look at protest music and change the world, man.
Trying to cause a big sensation.
People are not
going
to take it forever. They are fed up. They don't want to live in fear.
From classic Dylan to Plan B, Public Enemy to John Lennon.
Revolution Radio.
Bank Holiday Monday from midday on BBC Radio 6 Music.